session number 11307, reel 2.
Raymond Adams, reel 2.
The Admiral didn't really say a great deal new to us. I think we had a reasonable picture anyway, and we had taken a fair amount of interest in building the picture up, so I think we were able to understand what was going on most of the time. And I think we kept as far ahead with building the picture as we could, and perhaps slightly further ahead than one or two of my contemporaries in other ships, purely because of the signals we were able to read and the news broadcasts we were able to copy.
Did he give any particular impression of the strength of the Argentinian Navy to you? Can you remember?
Being a submariner, his main concern was the submarine threat, and much less of the air threat. But that's only in relative terms. And I think, from my perspective, from the signals that were coming out later, he was amazed that the submarine threat wasn't greater. And although the air threat itself perhaps shouldn't have been as great, looked at rationally, probably only due to the determination and the courage of Argentinian pilots, who were operating at the very extremes of their range, and in fact, as I understand, many of them over their range, I didn't make it back. Perhaps we underestimated the courage of the Argentinian pilots. But on the other hand, we expected more from the submariners.
What sort of air defences did you have? You know, you have this Sea Dart, and is that... You didn't have the Sea Wolf, did you?
No, we didn't have Sea Wolf. Sea Wolf is only a point defence weapon system, which is very close in and can really only defend one ship. It's a self-defence weapon. It's a very good weapon, very flexible, very responsive, but doesn't give protection any more than really your immediate couple of miles or so.
And is it a very low-range one, Sea Wolf? Is that the...
Sea Wolf can take targets out close to the water, yes. But that depends on how low and how close. But the primary threat in the past, when looking at Eastern Bloc systems, has always been a higher threat as opposed to the sea skimming missile. And Western sea skimming missiles are very potent weapons in terms of the fact they can get very low. But Sea Dart was there to give a force and area coverage. It was there to protect everybody as opposed to just individual ships. So Coventry's Sea Dart wasn't Coventry's weapon. It was a weapon which is used by the group air defence officer, in that he will allocate targets to specific ships' weapon systems. So the five air defence ships would have been allocated targets individually, depending on where the threat was coming from, by the man in charge, as opposed to ourselves. We would have relatively little say if we were acting as a group, whereas Sea Wolf is your weapon. It's not a force weapon.
It sounds from what you say that you felt very confident at this time, you know, that perhaps there was going to be a submarine threat which you could cope with, and that you know, having one of the latest 42 types, that you and a happy ship and a cohesive crew, that you felt very confident about things. Is that right, at this
stage?
Oh,
yes. Yes, I think we were supremely confident.
How about your captain? That this would be Captain Hart Dyke, would it?
Yes.
Yes. What sort of chap was he?
He was a very...
He still
quiet,
is, isn't he?
He still is, yes. He's just left the service. He is a very quiet, self-assured, very confident man, very competent captain, otherwise he wouldn't have been driving one of the newer ships. Very quiet and considerate person, very much a gentleman, and a very professional naval officer. I think also he was confident in our own abilities. I don't think there would have been any doubts.
What you, if you knew enough about the issue of the Falklands, and what you perceived as being the sort of justice of your cause at this stage, you know, did you have any particular feelings against the Argentinians?
I don't think anyone had any feelings against Argentina or the people as such. Certainly, I remember my family and friends who were alive during the Second World War had an inbuilt feeling against Germans, for example, or against Japanese, depending on where they were fighting. And we didn't have any of that against the Argentinians. They were just the threat. And the one advantage, I think, of naval warfare, in retrospect, is you don't see your enemy eye to eye. You can shoot down aircraft, but you don't actually see people. I don't think we had any feelings at all against the Argentinians, and certainly even afterwards, I haven't. A friend of mine suggested that, or wondered why I didn't hand back a prize which the Argentine Navy had given me when I was at Dartmouth, which is a standard yearly prize. And the my response was that I had absolutely no feelings at all about the Argentinians. I mean, firstly, the prize was for me and not from them, as it were. And secondly, they were just ordinary servicemen doing their business as well. We had no feelings at all. As to the rightness of our case, well, being British, we were obviously in the right and we were doing the government's business. If the government said, go and fight, then we went and fought. I don't think anyone was at all concerned about whether we were doing the right thing or not. And I think an individual's point of view, the fact that the Argentinians had invaded and we were there to re-establish British sovereignty made our case even more right. As to the long-standing dispute over the islands, that was almost irrelevant. And as far as we were concerned, the islands were British and we were there to recover them.
Were the sort of rules of engagement made clear to you fairly early on, you know, as you were getting nearer the area of the Falklands, before the battle order was given? Were you given advice as to, you know, if aircraft were sort of overhead, this sort of thing?
There is a fundamental difference in rules of engagement between British action and NATO, or British operations and NATO operations. Working as a part of a British unit, British operations, rules of engagement are very clearly laid down for all stages and at all times. And there is no such thing as a sort of blanket do what you like, as it were, although the inherent right of self-defence remains whatever your rules of engagement are. However, having said that, I'm sure they were perfectly clear, but I'm not sure I was in a position at that stage of my training to either understand them or to take much interest in them. My role did not involve being in the ops room. It was before my warfare officer training, and therefore my knowledge and experience of rules and engagements were pretty slight. But I have every confidence that the rules were firstly clear and secondly were quite just. And given the political leadership, then I'm sure if we'd had asked for rules of engagement, we'd have probably got them, unless there was a very good reason otherwise.
So what was your role as you were sort of steaming south? What were you doing on the Coventry?
Coventry was part of the spearhead, the lead group of ships. And there were about a half dozen warships and probably about three or four RFAs. We all headed after our replenishment at Ascension in a southwesterly direction. Initially, we were there to make a presence, I believe, although this is difficult to say from my particular individual position, we were there to demonstrate government resolve and show our determination. For that reason, we did not go south quietly, but we transmitted on radars and communications equipment. That way, the enemy know where you are. And of course, if everyone's transmitting, they tend to think you're a fairly large force. So part of our role probably was a bit of a strategic deception. And also, you can disguise the formation a little bit. We then paused about two-thirds of the way down in order to wait for other units to catch up. There's no point in everyone arriving in trips and drabs. And at that sort of stage, Plymouth and Antrim, I believe, were detached to head towards South Georgia and carry out their action down there. And the next we saw of them was 2 or 3 weeks later, by which stage they'd gone to South Georgia, recaptured, gone back to Ascension and come back down to the Falklands. The vastness of the South Atlantic is not something you appreciate until you start looking at a map. For example, it's just over 100 miles from the Falklands to South Georgia. South Georgia is Antarctic in climate and in terrain, and the Falklands are rather like a very windy Western Isle of Scotland, or perhaps the Shetlands or Orkneys. So there's a fundamental difference there. But it's also about 3,000 to 4,000 miles from Ascension to the Falklands, which is the width of the Atlantic and North Atlantic. So the actual scale of it is quite horrendous. So you did have to wait for everyone else to sort of catch up again.
Yes. Did you get that feeling that you were part of this task force? You know, is it possible, for instance, to look around and see other ships near and on the horizon, and to feel that you're part of a fleet?
Yes, we felt we were very much part of the initial force. We had very little news of what I understood later was a sort of big fleet sailing from Portsmouth, and that was totally beyond us. And the amphibious group after that, of course, could be on another planet. Our world consisted of these 8 or 10 ships in the middle of the South Atlantic. But you knew you were part of a group because you exercised almost continually on the way down there. And you worked very hard, you had maintenance days, but when you were operating together and exercising together, then of course you were part of a group. And this was an integral part of preparing for what was to come.
And what was your role at this time, May? What were you, a signals officer?
Yes, my main effort was firstly in my department to keep the communication systems running, not as a maintainer, but as to collate the vast number of signals that were coming in, and they were well in excess of anything we'd ever seen before, and to try and make some sense of it, and to make sure that the people who needed to see the signals saw them, because in peacetime, when you may only get a relatively small number of signals a day, then the captain, of course, can read every signal. When the signals are coming through, and they may not all be addressed to you, but may be of interest, then you can. Part of my job was to gain information around and make sure that the right people saw the right information in a timely manner, and within the bounds of security, also that the people who needed to see the signals saw them, people who didn't need to see the signals didn't see them, and that was a prime role within the signals organisation. My other role was as an officer of the watch on the bridge, which was one of my standard roles.
So were you having sort of extra long duties at this stage, you know, because it sounds that you were very overwhelmed with these signals?
Not overly so, surprisingly, because the workload outside the ship, although we had carried on exercising, was very specific and was in terms of quality rather than quantity. We were exercising within the ship. Watches, we were actually quite flushed with watchkeepers. We'd actually got more watchkeepers than we would normally have. So, in fact, our bridge watch bill was better. And the ship was not in defence watches. We were not in two watches, at least the officers weren't. and the majority ship's company weren't in two watches at this stage. The communicators were, but then the communicators tend to be in two watches anyway when they're at sea.
Was this a very different feeling than, say, the exercises you'd been doing near Gib?
Yes and no. No in that the whole of the Falklands, from being detached at Gibraltar to the very last moment when we were hit, was nothing, gave me the feeling, being nothing more than a large exercise. But on the other hand, we were able to cut out a lot of the bureaucratic nonsense that you end up with in peacetime, which stems from having to account for pennies and having to be fairly economical in your business, and also deal with the paperwork. Whereas the whole of the Falklands, we were able to put this to one side and look upon things in a very much more rational manner and say, is that really necessary? No, then it goes into a big gas shack in the corner. So yes and no, I think, is the answer to that.
You were talking about the South Georgia, you know, the recapture. What sort of effect did that have on the morale when you heard that South Georgia had been recaptured, you know, without loss of life particularly?
Most of the story didn't filter through, because much of what we learnt from outside sources, or the greater arena, the strategic area, came from the BBC World Service, because obviously there's not time in the normal run of the mill to put on news items onto the broadcast, and so it was a sort of very much a one-liner headline sort of material. So I think it boosted morale, but I don't think it was anything less than we expected. We didn't expect to not recapture South Georgia in the way that we didn't expect not to recapture the Falklands, that we were going down there to do a job of work and we would expect it to take a relatively short period of time. We'd evict this third world nation and then go back to doing what we always had been doing. So it was a job of work, and I don't think we expected anything less than the recapture of South Georgia. Fairly simply.
Did you hear about Margaret Thatcher, her rejoice at that stage? Did that come over the radio?
I can't remember it doing so, but I'm sure it would have been dealt with, received with a certain amount of cynicism. Because we were there to do a job of work, we tended to detach ourselves from the sort of political rhetoric and diplomatic goings-on that were outside. They were almost superfluous to what we were doing.
You were saying, and it's very interesting, you know, how the bureaucracy altered at this particular time. I wondered, you know, once you were put on into battle formation, what alterations there would have been in the ship? You know, did you, for instance, take furniture out of the way, pictures down? You know, was the ship altered in any way, ready for battle? Can you remember? Did you do without a few luxuries, for instance, in furnishings and fittings?
We secured the ship for action, but while we were there, most of the time we were in defence watches, because the Type 42 is able to fight with just half the ship's company turned to. Where you do suffer is damage control, but that's another matter. But you're able to defend yourself and fire weapon systems in two watches. And in order to live in two watches, you can't tie everything down so it's immovable. There needs to be a certain amount that you need to be able to do. So we had a sort of a balance between being well secured for action and making the place reasonably habitable. So there were changes. Pictures which were secure to the bulkhead, screwed to the bulkhead, stayed. Loose and movable items were secured, and that was the main change.
I was wondering also, you know, about your family. When you had this sort of crossing over procedure, you know, with those going home, were you able to sort of send messages and, you know, things to your wife? You're married, and you wouldn't have had children then, I imagine. But were you married then?
No, I wasn't. Yeah. We were due to get married in August, which we did anyway. By sheer chance on the same day. But we were able to send mail across And the last mail drop was via Aurora, and she took it home. The next mail was via Ascension. And then after that, it was intermittent.
Is there any sort of special procedure, though, when you go into battle? Particularly, you know, when you're in a peace situation and something like this flares up. I was wondering, with things like insurance and wills, do they sort of do anything like that on deck?
You, as a division officer, you encourage your division to have a will anyway, and also to take out life insurance. It didn't worry me because I had both from virtually the moment I joined the service. But those who hadn't got wills, there is the ability to make a will on board, and then these are dispatched whenever possible.
Can you remember the signal to prepare for war? Or hearing of this?
I vaguely remember a signal saying that we were about to go into action. If I kept a copy, it was probably still waterlogged in the bottom of my trousers somewhere.
Would you have been within the exclusion zone at that time?
I'm not sure I personally remember the scope of the exclusion zone vis-a-vis our position at the beginning of May. The only thing I do remember is the fact that as from the 1st of May, then we were in a shooting war as opposed to waiting for the outcome. We had grouped up with the carriers a couple of days before the end of April, but we were still some way off at that stage.
Another thing I was going to ask you was the United States, you know, whether you had any particular feelings about America and whether America was going to help or whether Britain would be alone at this time. Was there any sort of discussion or talk about American cooperation?
I think the only thing that I remember was some vague discussion in the mess about one of the American diplomats who appeared to be siding with the South Americans in a sort of solidarity of American states type stance. I can't remember who that was, but the United States we considered as an ally, and this was an aberration. We felt if there was any help, then it should be coming our way.
And was there any help coming your way?
Not to Coventry.
How about the situation with the AWACS? Was there any resentment towards the United States that they did not allow you to use theirs?
I'm not sure AWACS aircraft would have been able to operate in that area anyway. Certainly to use carrier-based aircraft, we couldn't have used them from our carriers. And AWACS aircraft, of course, would have needed land basing, and there was, of course, nowhere really that was suitable. What did come out of it, I think by sort of traditional British muddling through, we managed to get it right in the end, or as right as possible, was the fact that when we had the normal, or the conventional carriers, the old Ark-Royal, the Eagle, etc., we had an airborne early warning aircraft called the Gannet, and its job was to be airborne in the same way the AWACS was to give extended coverage of air attack or shipping or whatever. With the loss of the conventional carriers, then we lost this capability, and we had to relearn this lesson very quickly. And what happened was that the Sea King helicopter was fitted with a searchwater radar, which was strapped half on the side and half underneath, searchwater being the Nimrod radar. And this was used as a sort of temporary ad hoc arrangement to provide airborne early warning. And in fact, it's something we have since developed, but it only grew out of the requirements to have something airborne in 1982. So I think we had to relearn our lesson there, and it's something we in the service had always been concerned about. But of course, service considerations aren't always the same as political ones.
Right, so now we go into the action of Coventry, don't we? And I suppose this is from early May, isn't it? With, first of all, is it Port Stanley Airfield was attacked? Did this sort of signal the beginning of events, would you say?
Yes, we by listening in on other people's signals, reading other people's signals, and the messages that were coming to us, we knew that the Vulcan attack would be carried out on the morning of the 1st of May. I think it's something we expected, although it was a very long range and fairly tenuous sort of operation, and one beset, or likely to be beset with problems. We in the service had lost the carriers, we believe, because of the RAF's statement that they could supply air defence anywhere in the world, which we believe to be farcical. And perhaps 1982 brought it out. But this was an effort to try and provide air defence and forward air support. That was also followed up by a Harrier raid on the airfield. And I think our confidence was such that we expected it to go off and the airfield to be hit without any problems at all. Perhaps in retrospect we were a little bit overconfident. Having lost one aircraft, I think it was in the Harrier raid, actually it wasn't a bad effort for two air attacks on an enemy airfield. And that happened in the morning of the 1st of May, I believe it was. At this stage, we in the ships remained in Greenwich time, which had major advantages. Firstly, because all signals we write in Zulu or Greenwich time anyway, so there was no worrying about time problems. And secondly, it meant that we got up 4 or 5 hours before dawn, which meant that in normal terms, the first air attack we could expect was about stand easy. And then because most of the raids were daytime raids, or daylight raids, they tended to finish about 6 o'clock in the evening. So actually, domestically, it was absolutely ideal.
The next event, I suppose, would that have been the sinking of the Belgrano?
Yes, I think that must have been the following day. The dates are a little bit hazy. The only reason I remember the 1st of May was my sister's wedding, which I was supposed to be at, was that afternoon. Things were going reasonably well. We'd had a few radar contacts around. We knew roughly where the carrier and the Belgrano groups were. And although we didn't necessarily know our own, we in individual ships didn't actually know our own submarine strength, we expected one or both to have a submarine in fairly close confines. The Belgrano we heard about through a signal saying that it had been sunk and given a quick précis of the action. And of course, this was a great boost to morale, which is nothing less than we expected, of course. The only disappointment, perhaps, at the time would have been the fact that the Conqueror didn't sink both escorts as well. But that might have been a little bit unnecessary.
Was this seen as a great threat, the Belgrano? I'm wondering, you know, you say it gave a boost to your morale. Was it seen as a threat?
Yes, all the surface units were seen as a potential threat. And the Argentinian surface fleet was reasonably strong. Belgrano had some potent weapons. She was a fairly old ship, but on the other hand, she still carried a reasonable punch. And the aircraft carrier, the 25th of May, likewise, plus a host of associated escorts. And we had practiced anti-surface operations on the way down. surface action groups, which we had we had practiced our procedures and actually worked out really quite well against surface units. But the best way of taking out a surface unit is by a submarine at long range, or by an aircraft at long range.
This was outside the exclusion zone, wasn't it? The sinking of the Belgrano. Did you know that at the time, or did you have any particular feelings about it?
No, I don't think I did. I personally knew about it at the time. But any feelings we would have had would have been, it was a threat, therefore it should have been taken out. 1 mile outside, 1 mile inside. And a matter of 2 miles can't make that much difference whether a thing is a threat or not. You have to deal in handfuls.
Did you know anything at the time about the great debate at home, you know, about the sinking of the Belgrano? And, you know, a lot of feelings against it, feelings of guilt, or, you know, that it shouldn't have happened?
No, we certainly weren't aware.